Washington, D.C., eh?
Yes, sir.
Next stop, Washington, D.C. Well, I guess we might as well get underway again and I hope those of you who went to the North Slope Borough found it it useful. I should say that I believe Steve Cacfui, president of the Dene Nation, is here, and I was going to invite him to sit at the round table when he comes. He might we might give him the Bernard Nietzschman chair over there beside Raina that is kind of to start with Daly Sambo of the Inuit Circumpolar Conference has a few words to say just before we start the discussion.
Thank you. I regret that I haven't been able to sit in the roundtable session and listen to all of the discussion that has taken place here. For the most part, it's because I've been active with the fundraising effort to keep the commission alive and on the road and for these roundtable hearings to be held. So I am in and out of here calling foundations. I just finished a proposal to the Episcopal Church Foundation that had to be in by a certain deadline, so that's one reason why I've been in and out of the discussion. The reason why I wanted the opportunity to speak is because there have been a number of different church organizations who have generously supported the work of the commission, both through political and moral support and generating awareness amongst their congregations and memberships, as well as direct financial assistance. And I think that it's very remarkable that Josephine Bigler from the Global Ministries of the United Methodist Church made her way to Anchorage, Alaska to see firsthand what it is that this Alaska Native Review Commission project is doing and hopes to do in the future. The United Methodist Church gave a direct grant of over $15,000 for the work of this commission, and I think that it has certainly been put to good use, and it's very much appreciated by the Inuit Circumpolar Conference and the Alaska Native Review Commission. And Josephine, I know that you're here somewhere, and thank you very much. The other churches who have shown support and also generated awareness not just in the United States, but worldwide. The World Council of Churches, the Program to Combat Racism, contributed. They are headquartered in Geneva, Switzerland, and gave us a contribution as well. The Unitarian Church under the Veach Program has contributed also, and greatly, in fact, and we're very appreciative of that. We have prospective donors in the church world as well. The Episcopal Church Foundation, as I just mentioned, I submitted a proposal. The local churches have endorsed the proposal and will be sending along their endorsement to the National Church Foundation. Also, the Trinity Church, the Presbyterian Church, both on a local level as well as a national level, have shown support, and hopefully they'll do it by giving us some money as well. Those people we have contacted that hope to not give financial support, but hope to assist the Alaska Native peoples in their cause, in the future, then the National Council of Churches and also the American Friends Service Committee. I continue to fundraise and hope that the churches not only support with financial contributions and in-kind services, but also in the work that the Alaska Native people have ahead of themselves in terms of making some changes to the provisions of the Native Claims Settlement Act that need and require immediate attention, but also hope that they're there for other activities that the Native peoples will be carrying on in the future. Now, for some of the discussion that I have been able to take in, there have been some things said that I'd just like to point out, and I'll just briefly read some of the notes that I have related to the discussion. And it's been through my experience of the fundraising effort that has been just over a year's worth of time that I've put energy and money and a lot of writing into in terms of raising the funds that I've an awareness that I've gained about the place of Native peoples in the Western world and the type of force that they have. I feel it's important for Native peoples to realize that we have a tremendous power in the United States, that we have a moral power, that we have an opportunity to get the appeal and the support of non-Native peoples for gaining justice. We can mobilize this support. We can mobilize it through the churches, through other friendly organizations. There is, I feel, a measure of goodwill towards Native people to have a force in this world, a moral force, a moral power to gain what is rightfully ours. There will have to be room for compromise, some give and take, and that we must be prepared for that. The local control of the resources through safe and wise use and development of our resources, all of the things that we have been talking about in other roundtables and in this roundtable, these types of things were reiterated and resounded by people like Hugh Brody, who stated that there is a staggering opportunity for justice in the North, that Native people can harbor and protect the values that many people care about, and in particular, Native peoples and their values. He further stated that we shouldn't be fatalistic. Let us not be fatalistic. Let us be realistic. We have been reminded here that there is time, that there is an opportunity to think about the issues, to change, and to plan, that there is time to plan, to realize this opportunity, build those alliances, cultivate them, and move forward in a positive way. Just on a point that Vernet Kirkness had made, I wanted to respond to it, that young people were cited in education of young people and youth, not only here in Alaska, but amongst all indigenous peoples, have played a role and have played a part in Alaska. With my position at the ICC, I speak to young people in high schools, at churches, through Native culture clubs. I've spoken to young people in detention facilities, at youth conferences that are held in the state. They are concerned not only about the issues facing us on a regional or statewide level, but also on an international level. They've gained awareness about the issues facing the indigenous peoples and are concerned about it, and I think play a major role. And they themselves have a great moral force and a great moral power to attempt to bring about some change. So there is awareness, however, there's no limit to it. All of us can attempt to touch the lives of young Native people for the improvement and betterment of all Native peoples. Thank you for your time, and again, the roundtables and this entire project have been supported by many, many different foundations, church organizations, and again, on behalf of the ICC and the Alaska Native Review Commission, I thank all of them.
Thank you, Daley. Maybe I could just say that Daley Sambo has really made an outstanding contribution to the success of the commission, not only through her fundraising efforts, which have been remarkable and have enabled the commission to stay on the road, and even to return to Anchorage. And but her sound advice and experience and wisdom beyond her years have been invaluable to me throughout the course of our journeys. And when I say keep us on the road, I think it, since we are almost at the last day when this commission will be sitting, that it isn't just a case of getting me around the villages. Jim Sykes, our sound man, he's on the phone, but you know, all you all know Jim Sykes has taken the tapes of all the evidence. They've been transcribed. They form a permanent record that may be unique in Alaskan history of the views and aspirations and concerns of Alaska Native people. Those meetings in the villages were organized by local people and with the cooperation of local village and regional corporations and tribal governments and nonprofit groups, and they were also organized by members of our staff, Mary Kenswick, whom many of you know, and Eileen McLean, who worked with us until August when she ran for office in the North Slope Borough and was elected to the Assembly and is now in Barrow. And I should say that the meetings we've held recently have been organized by Joyce Johnson of our staff and Asta Keller. And while I'm paying tribute to all these folks, let me not omit Don Gamble, who really served as coordinator of all the Commission's activities from its inception until December 1984, when he returned to Canada. And his job, he worked closely when he was here with Doric Meshaw, and now Doric is doing all the work that Don and he used to do together. And I know you all appreciate, as I do, the contribution that that all of these folks have made. And I'm glad Daly did speak, because it gave me an opportunity to pay tribute to all of those persons. Well, I think we're ready for the Nietzschman Sanders Charche Davis Shu Hanke sextet. So go ahead, Bernie, you start off.
Thank you. Well, I'm a geographer, and geographers have a long view of history and a close view of the land. But you don't have to be a geographer, an anthropologist, or a lawyer. You don't have to be a professional to know what's going on. Internationally, if you look around, you don't have to know much about native and non-native worlds to understand. Just follow the transfer of land and the containment of rights. You don't have to know much about politics to understand. Just follow which way the refugees go, the external refugees, and in many countries, the internal refugees. Some of my remarks might appear to some to be blunt, but where I work, we operate beyond state laws and on the other side of the frontier of justice, where it is the power to impose and the power to defend that counts. And recourse to rights is directed to defending, not asking for rights, as well as trying to educate a state and the world community of states about a people and about a people's right. If one accepts definitions from other worlds about the fourth world, other worlds being the first, second, and third who write the books, the fourth world doesn't exist. Native peoples are not supposed to have politics, sovereignty, ownership of land and resources, nationality and economy, or any distinct rights as distinct peoples. The title for our roundtable, The Place of Native Peoples in the Western World, has a lot of meaning to me, not only as a geographer, but also knowing about other struggles for a place. A place not meaning a role, but a place that has an area, a place that is bounded, a territory. Of course, we could also reword our title. Maybe we should think about it sometime. The place of the West in the Native world. Well, we've heard about De Las Casas and Sepúlveda and their views on the right to enslave versus the right to liberty. I want to start off by using another example briefly. Some of you know this example. But to get us to think about individual rights and group rights, because that's where a lot of the land claims rest. And I want to do this with briefly bringing us to think about a debate that started off and became very one-sided between these people on the same side, Sir Henry Sumner Maine and Lewis Henry Morgan, late half of the 19th century, who used kinship and territory to distinguish between the forms of social organization and what they called ancient society and modern society. Both were lawyers and both wrote books. Maine wrote Ancient Law, 1861. Morgan wrote Ancient Society, 1877. Both had an important effect on anthropology and perceptions on territory. As a result of their work, some people think that anthropologists went off to study kinship without territories, and others went out to study political territory without natives. Well, like Maine, Morgan distinguished between what he called primitive society, and that was based on ties of kinship, and modern civil society that was based on relations of property and territory. And I'd like to share an excerpt from Morgan's book, Ancient Society, where he writes, "All forms of government are reducible to two general plans. In their bases, the two are fundamentally distinct. The first, in order of time, is founded upon persons and upon relations purely personal and may be distinguished as a society. The second is founded upon territory and upon property and may be distinguished as a state. The township or ward, circumscribed by metes and bounds with the property it contains, is the basis or unit of the latter, and the political society is the result. Political society is organized upon territorial areas and deals with property as well as with persons through territorial relations. In ancient society, this territorial plan was unknown, and when it came in, it fixed the boundary line between ancient and modern society. What these people were arguing was that territory gradually came to substitute itself for kinship as the primary political bond. Well, many people disagreed, Lowy and others, at this speculative history, and many people later came to see the errors in that interpretation. But you don't leave territory out just because you talk about kinship. But print sticks. And first print sticks best. These ideas influenced, as well as many, many others, I'm just using this as an example of the time, these ideas and others influenced the conceptualization of individual rights and group rights. Many of other people spoke about these ideas and from times before Morgan and Maine. But it came to be that the state or the world's family of states might accept individual rights, that is, human rights, by accepting native peoples as citizens. But to accept group rights to territory would be to accept the existence of a separate state and a separate political society. You may recall the definition I gave from the United Nations of a minority, a citizen. That had said nothing about territory, nothing about sovereignty, nothing about self-determination, and nothing about resources. Well, in the 18th century and with the French Revolution, the idea of a nation was a liberating force. A nation of a people with a common territory could determine their political leadership and become a nation state. But by the mid-19th century, the nation state was no longer a liberating force, but a controlling force that attempted to forge a common allegiance from different peoples that might be contained by that nation state. Different peoples that claim distinct territorial areas. I use Indonesian as example. The motto of the nation state of Indonesia is unity in diversity. It's 300 different peoples. Whereas one of the groups fighting against that unity through in diversity, which translates as the Javanization of Indonesia, the Free Papua Movement, the OPM, their motto is one people, one soul. We heard Moani tell us this morning, we're being denied our identity, our culture. In West Papua, because of the Indonesian state, it is illegal to call West Papua West Papua. It is illegal to identify as a Papuan. You are an Irianese. You are a part of Irian Jaya. Reference to Melanesian people is prohibited. The word Melanesian cannot appear in a newspaper or book in Indonesia. They are to be called Indonesians. I'd like to share with you some thoughts I've been jotting down and trying to put together a book on rights. And I want to start off by sharing some of my researches in individual and group rights, because we hear a lot about these rights, but they're very distinct, and some have been won, and some have yet to be won. And then I'll share with you some comments about the United Nations, and I'm sure others here in this sextet we'll have much more to say about the international legislation. I'm going to start by quoting Brooklyn Rivera from Isura Sata, where he starts off saying, all governments are anti-Indian. They have internal colonization, racism, policies of assimilation. So we have to be the protagonists. That's the only way we can be sure that we can guarantee our freedom and rights as a group, as Indian peoples, not just as individuals. So you can see our struggle is not just to defeat the Sandinistas in our land. We have more reasons. Our dignity, the real genuine liberation of the Indian people, our Indian people. And that's the core of that struggle, and that is the core of many, many struggles, whether it unfortunately be armed, political, or legal. Is that distinguishing between the individual rights, some of which have been won and some of which are important, but group rights as a people. Now, human rights is interesting because widespread recognition of human rights and condemnation of their violation are rather recent and continually evolving developments in international law. The abuse of by a country of its people, by its government, the abuse of a people in a country by its government was once thought to be considered only a domestic problem and not really subject to international concern. And this is no longer the case. It's generally accepted that the rights of individuals and of peoples in any one nation state are or should be the concern of the world community of nation states and peoples. And various international laws and organizations have come into existence to protect and to monitor and to bring to public attention human rights violations. Now, just because there are recognized human rights in international laws does not mean that violations will be reduced in many countries. As yet, no effective international courts or international police system exists to monitor or to enforce these human rights in a meaningful way. However, this doesn't mean that governments have free rein to abuse individuals, minorities, native peoples, native nations, without within one state's borders without being brought to some sort of international accountability. Certainly to bring to public attention violations of human rights can bring political, in some cases even economic, pressure and world opinion to bear, in which some cases may limit or curtail the violations. Well, internationally, it's generally accepted, and I quote here, that all individuals and all peoples of the world have certain basic rights which countries must respect. These rights are called human rights. And David, if you'll allow me, I'd like just to lean over here and use this to, this is Indian Rights and Human Rights, has been put out at the end of last year by the Indian Law Resource Center, an NGO in Washington, D.C. And this is a handbook not to explain simply what rights are, but a handbook to explain to Native leaders how they may go about demanding and working toward recognition of individual and group rights. So it's a handbook, not just a compilation of what laws are out there. So this thing that people have kinship and not territory or land claims, that when they become citizens, they may have human rights as individuals, but not group rights, has still on the modern scene. It's very much at the heart of evolving concern and law to have these rights recognized. Human rights that are part of international laws and agreements and which have been approved by many countries internationally include the right to life and personal integrity free from physical or psychological abuse, the right to a nationality, the right to freedom from genocide, torture, and slavery, the right to freedom from arbitrary arrests, the right to freedom of movement, the right to privacy, the right to own property, the right to freedom of speech, religion, assembly, the right of peoples to self-determination, the right to preserve culture, religion, and language, the right to adequate food, shelter, health care, and education. Well, one of the aspects of international law is evolving is to extend these rights to groups, not just to add more individual rights, but to groups of individuals that may be an ethnic minority or a native people, an indigenous nation. Western legal concepts and much of international law, as we all know, are strongly oriented to individual, not group rights, based on ideas of common property, the rights of an individual to property, the rights of an individual. However, in many non-Western countries, the rights of a group, not the individual, dominate. And laws from one cultural tradition may not protect or reflect another cultural tradition. Indigenous peoples, native peoples, Indian peoples who hold and use land and resources communally and who may claim historical group rights of ownership generally seek international and national recognition of group rights. In fact, group rights are the most endangered of all rights for many native peoples worldwide. Now, just because people seek them, those rights nevertheless must be won from central governments that claim, sort of paradoxically, the right to be the only group-forming entity. Of course, all of this is in the name of the state and the individual. The state's right to do so often simply comes from the power to do so, or from the fact that the states agree to do so, as well as from unilateral claims to historical conquest, sovereignty, or the inheritance left from the departure of a colonial power. As many of us have heard about colonization and decolonization, even revolutions of national liberation, this often does little more than replace, not remove, central government claims of sovereign rights. In other words, the third world is doing to the fourth world what the first world used to do to the third world. And that's happening everywhere. Particularly appropriate to the situation of many Indian peoples in Central and South America, and especially in Guatemala and Nicaragua, are some observations by John Bodley in a book called Victims of Progress, when he wrote, Many newly independent nations have followed an active policy of exerting control over tribal areas in the professed interest of national unity. Economic considerations aside, government authorities see the existence of a fully autonomous tribal population within its boundaries of the state as a challenge to their authority and a possible invitation to aggression by foreign powers. This has been particularly true where tribal populations occupy remote border areas. And he goes on, he says, it's become fashionable to describe tribal peoples as national minorities, and as such, even to speak to them as obstacles to national unity and sources of instability. Newly independent nations have often been eager to politically incorporate zones that former colonial governments had left relatively undisturbed, on the theory that such zones have been deliberately perpetrated in order to create division within the country. Well, many native peoples maintain that they are separate peoples, communities, or nations, and that they are not ethnic minorities within the national population. And many native peoples resist attempts by central governments, central authorities, and social scientists to describe them as ethnic groups, ethnic minorities, or national minorities, as simply the terminology of colonialism. A group's recognition of itself as a people and the acceptance of that entity by a central government has considerable psychological and political weight. On the other hand, an ethnic group might be absorbed by the dominant society, an ethnic group can be broken down more easily, an ethnic group can be divided more easily into parts. The rights to self-determination remain a principal goal. And recognizing the United Nations Charter, the right of self-determination of peoples is described in the two United Nations International Covenants on Human Rights. And Shelton shared some of those with us day before yesterday. And these pertain to the determination of what's called a people, not an ethnic minority or an ethnic group, a people with a common identity and a common territory actually inhabited, or one that they would wish to reclaim. All peoples have the right to self-determination. By virtue of that right, they freely determine their own political status and freely pursue their economic, social, and cultural development. All peoples may, for their own ends, freely dispose of their natural wealth and resources without prejudice to any obligations arising out of international economic cooperation, based upon the principle of mutual benefit and international law. In no case may a people be deprived of its own means of subsistence. Another point, the state's parties to the present covenant, including those having responsibility for the administration of non-self-governing and trust territories, shall promote the realization of the right of self-determination and shall respect that right in conformity with the provision of the Charter of the United Nations. In principle, this sounds good, sounds excellent. It would appear that Indian people's rights to self-determination are covered by this international law. But as stressed in this handbook, Indian Rights and Human Rights, the concept of group rights is still evolving, and the right of self-determination is not fully established for Indian peoples under international law. The state will, in reality, I speak generally and internationally here, will recognize individual political rights of individuals in native populations. But recognition of group political rights and group sovereignty is often, usually actually, limited to avoid competition, sometimes called political subversion, with the state. When you go down the list of what the states impose, of course, Indian rights are what's left over. I have a list here of United Nations laws and so on, and which many of you will know from your own work in seeking what is already on the books. But I think I would rather have some others speak to those who've worked on them more directly and have been to Geneva concerning these group rights. So I will end here. Thank you.
Thank you, Bernie, very much. Doug, is it appropriate to ask you to pick it up there, or? Doug Sanders.
It's important to remember that international law is not in its origins a truly international law. It's not a global law. It's a law which was developed by the Western European expansionist powers, and it developed in the context of colonialism. The preoccupation of early international law was then essentially the relations between the imperialist powers. It did not come into being with any intent of defining the rights of the European colonial powers in relation to populations which were being subjugated. The point that international law is not neutral politically and not truly universal has been made many times, and particularly by the Third World nations in the period of formal decolonization in the years after the Second World War. And there has, in fact, been quite a lot of effort from the Third World to attempt to alter the bias or eliminate the bias of international law, which was historically in favor of the Western European powers. What's going on now can be seen as a kind of parallel, I think, to that effort by the Third World, or perhaps even an extension of that. It's again an attempt to get at inherent biases in international law, which are completely understandable in terms of the history and function of international law. Thomas said a few times about how the Marshall judgments build on international law. And that's what Marshall says in the judgments. It's rather interesting, there are no footnotes. No footnotes. I mean, as an academic, I was scandalized when I first saw this. And it's very interesting. At one point, I thought, when we were trying to figure out some aspects of the concept of trusteeship, perhaps the international law of trust territories will, you know, we can find some source material there. So you go to the international law trust materials, trusteeship materials from the going back to the days of the League of Nations, and what do you find? What's their footnote? Their footnote's the Marshall judgments. Now, I asked Professor Henke 2 days ago if he could supply the footnote, which is, was Cohen right that it all linked back to Las Casas and Vitoria? And Henke said, what I knew in my heart to be true, that you can't just jump 300 years like that. It isn't really there. The truth is, I think, that the principles, to the degree that they were developed, began with the colonial experience in North America. And to the degree that similar concepts develop in international law and in relation to subsequent areas of colonial expansion, such as Africa, the footnotes don't go back before the Marshall pronouncements. So it's not that this is not a way of attacking Marshall, but it's a way of trying to understand that the process of altering international law, of getting beyond the historical biases of international law in this area, in many ways begin with Marshall making up international law in the 1820s and depoliticizing it to a fair degree. I mean, when the basic question is asked, when Marshall himself poses the basic question, by what right? A phrase I've always liked and that our chairperson has used a few times over the last couple of days, by what basic right? Marshall avoids it. And he says, if I can freely translate him, look, it was the U.S. government that set up this court. Am I supposed to make a pronouncement of the illegitimacy of the United States government and therefore the illegitimacy of this court? And on that, he explicitly refers to a power relationship. He says the force, the power that lies behind this, the success of colonialism has created this court, and I'm in no position to challenge it.